Well, happy Father's Day to all of you fathers and fatherish folk who have poured your lives into others in meaningful ways. Fathering is an interesting thing, isn't it? I've obviously never been one, but I've had the opportunity to watch many fathers either falter or flourish. And it's because I'm a people watcher. And I remember one father who I observed in a grocery store. And he made a rookie mistake of walking his four-year-old child down the aisle that has toys in it. Now, he was probably on his way to get milk or eggs or something like that, but he picked an unfortunate route. And like I said, rookie. Because the four-year-old, oh, before I start, is anyone here named Gregory? Okay, this child was named Gregory. And he had zeroed in on some cheap, shiny thing and said, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, I have to have this." And rookie dad said, "No, Gregory, that is not what we came to get. Let's just go and get what we need and then we'll go home." Well, Gregory possessed two things, persistence and a voice that shattered glass. And he exhibited both in response to rookie dad's suggestion. "I demonstrate, but I'd break our sound system." So suffice it to say, Gregory disagreed passionately and repeated his request in a piercing wail that's just south of the tones that dogs hear, but sufficient to cause hearing loss in anyone else within a half mile. Rookie Dad, to his credit, stayed calm. He said, and this is where I exhibited my lack of control, for which I still repent nightly in the dark. He said, "Now, Gregory, you're not being fair to Daddy. Please be fair to Daddy, and we'll get what we came for. Please, 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 Gregory, be fair to Daddy." And here I muttered under my breath, sadly during a point in time where Gregory was taking one, so my muttering was clearly audible. Oh, for crying out loud. Rookie Dad looked at me with daggers. And Gregory took it as a renewed inspiration to redouble his efforts. So I smiled weakly, and I turned my cart around and avoided them for the rest of my shopping trip, which was easy, because I knew exactly where they were. Gregory was very persistent. Fatherhood is not for wimps. Well, I'll tell you a father story from my own family. We have two kids, Ben and I. We have Melissa, who I think a lot of you know Melissa. And then we have David, who's an attorney. So very few people outside of his clients and his immediate family have ever seen him. When he was younger, he was small and thin. Now he's over 6'3". And when he was younger, he and Ben would get in epic wrestling matches in our family room. And Ben had a distinct advantage for most of David's childhood in terms of strategy and mass. But David was a master strategist, which serves him well in law, and he bided his time, and as he did, he grew. And one day, as they were wrestling, and Ben began to get tired, Ben used his heretofore winning strategy of just lying on top of David and smothering him, assuming that David would soon give up. But David did not. In fact, he kind of angled for purchase, and then he simply stood up, with Ben on his upper back, trying not to drop. And as I recall, David just went in the kitchen and got himself a snack, with Ben still up there. And this is when Mom stepped in, that would be me, and declared a mom edict that there will be no more wrestling. And I think Ben's body thanks me because that was the end of that. But this incident symbolized a transition in their lives. David was growing into manhood, and it was his time to move forward and find his own way. And it was Ben's time to recede in terms of his role in directing David's life. That's what I'm talking about today, kind of, sort of. Transition in leadership, when one leader comes to an end of his time and role, and another steps in to take the place. And we're talking, if you read the newsletter, about Moses and Joshua. So before I start, I want to give a bit of a disclaimer, which seems to be a necessary and time-honored liturgy of the teaching team. I'm a big fan of the Bible, and I have a healthy respect and reverence for it. And I have in my journey gone from being one of those "the Bible said it, I believe it, and that settles it" people to one who has wrestled with the seeming contradictions within its pages, and the places where the stories don't quite add up to the evidence and science that we now have access to. In short, I've decided to let the Bible be what it was intended to be. I've come up with a couple things that have given me some amount of comfort, because I say this glibly now, but that wasn't an easy transition for me. There was a point in time when I was afraid to underline in my Bible because it was God's word. The first thing that kind of comforts me, and honestly, I've misquoted it in earlier sermons, so I'm kind of glad to have this opportunity to correct myself. I attribute it to Richard Rohr, who actually used it, but it was first said by theologian Marcus Borg. Sorry, my throat is dry today, so I will be drinking water in the service. Anyway, I'm sorry, Marcus. And here's the quote. The Bible is true, and some of it actually happened. I like that. And the second is my own analogy. One of my favorite books growing up was Gone with the Wind, the story of Scarlett O'Hara and her tumultuous life in her relationship with Rhett Butler and others, in the pages of Gone with the Wind during Civil War. Now, in the pages, there's a whole lot of Civil War history. Some of it's accurate and some of it's not. But it was set forth to make a point. So if you want to get an accurate account of the Civil War, Gone with the Wind is not your best resource. It was meant to illustrate the relationship between Scarlett and Rhett and others in her family circle, and to show how different people reacted to and affected by the tragedies of war, the loss of privilege, the struggle for survival, and in the midst of devastation, how it all worked together. The Civil War piece was simply a backdrop. Well, the Bible was given to us to illustrate God's relationship with humanity. Much of the history and the science is likely flawed because the writers didn't have access to much of the stuff that we have now. And they didn't write it from a scientific or historic perspective. Those were the backdrop and not the point of the writing. So how can it be true then? Well, it is true to the extent that it gives an accurate picture of the things it was meant to show. God's love for and relationship with humanity, and how God wants us to live with that, with God, with other humans, with nature, and with ourselves. That's the point. So when I recount the following stories, I'm just going to breeze past a bunch of vignettes. You may get distracted and say, well, did that really happen? Or how could that have happened? Don't do that. Let's just look at it and see what is this story trying to illustrate? What does God want us to take from it? Well, so who were Moses and Joshua anyway? Who was Moses? We've all heard of him in his story, but here are some of the highlights. He was one of the most well-known and significant figures in the Bible. He was a prophet, a lawgiver, and a leader. He's best known for being chosen by God to rescue the Israelites from the slavery of Egypt, guiding them through the wilderness, receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. Just by way of review, here's some highlights. His mother, to save his life from the Egyptian edict decreeing that all male Jewish boys under the age of 2 should be put to death, put him in a basket and sent him floating down the Nile, where he was rescued by none other than Pharaoh's daughter. There, he was educated, cared for, and he grew in both knowledge and strength, and for the most part, wisdom, with a few dips here and there. As an adult, Moses witnessed an Egyptian overseer beating a Hebrew slave, and he was consumed with a sense of justice. So he killed the Egyptian in a fit of anger. When it was discovered, he fled to the land of Midian, where he married Zipporah and became a shepherd. So one day while tending his sheep, God appeared to Moses in a bush that burned but was not consumed. There, God commissioned Moses to return to Egypt to lead the Israelites to freedom. Back in Egypt, when Moses unveiled his plan, Pharaoh repeatedly refused to release the Israelite slaves. God worked through Moses to unleash 10 devastating plagues, concluding with the death of every firstborn in Egypt, but passing over the houses of the Israelites. just where we get Passover. This final plague led Pharaoh to relent and let the Israelites leave. However, as they left, Pharaoh had an epiphany. There goes my workforce. So he changed his mind. Pursued by the Egyptian army, the Israelites found themselves trapped between the army and the Red Sea. Of course, there was panic at the disco and a lot of grumbling. And Moses cried out to God. God commanded Moses to raise his staff, parting the waters so the Hebrews could walk through on dry ground. And then, once they had done so, the waters came back in and drowned all the Egyptian army. God then established a covenant with the Israelites and delivered the Ten Commandments along with the foundational laws for the nation to Moses on Mount Sinai. But while Moses was on the mountain, the grumbling Israelites became restless and wanted a tangible thing to worship. Under the direction, or at least the tacit approval of Aaron, they donated the gold that they had taken from the Egyptians. And when I say taken, they didn't steal it, they were given it. And they constructed a golden calf to worship. Moses was furious with the Israelites and with Aaron for allowing this to happen. But they press on despite it and continue their wanderings in the wilderness. Finally, they're within sight of the promised land. Moses, despite all of these amazing scenarios, had a temper. And on times along the road, the temper would lash out on his own accord rather than waiting on God to direct his actions. And because of this tendency, God had forbidden him or barred him from entering the promised land. However, before he died, God allowed Moses to climb up on Mount Nebo and view the promised land from afar. Okay? So that's Moses in a nutshell. What about Joshua? Well, Joshua is famously the son of Nun. If you've had children, they'll say, who beside Jesus did not have an earthly father? And then you say Joshua because he was the son of Nun. Anyway. He was from the tribe of Ephraim, but his birth name actually wasn't Joshua. It was Hosea, meaning salvation or deliverance. Later, Moses changed his name to Yeshua or Joshua, which adds the name of God to the meaning, translating Yahweh is salvation. Joshua was born in Egypt prior to the Exodus and spent his early years experiencing the harsh realities of the Hebrew slavery. And as he grew, he became a very capable military leader. Shortly after the Exodus, he led the Israelites in a battle against the Amalekites in Rephidim. Moses chose Joshua to be one of the 12 spies sent out to explore the promised land of Canaan. Along with Caleb, he was the only spy who brought back a positive, optimistic report about the conquered land, which ultimately allowed him to be one of the few Israelites who had originally left Egypt to enter the promised land. Joshua served as Moses' personal assistant from his youth. His temperament actually was more steady than the fiery Moses. And at one point, when Moses despaired, Joshua remained at the tent of meeting at the place where God usually went with Moses, even though Moses had walked away. Joshua spent decades serving Moses, along with honing his military prowess. He saw Moses at his best, and he saw Moses at his worst. And he stored these things in his heart and learned from them. Despite this, I personally don't think that Joshua ever conceived that he would be chosen as leader of Israel, and likely thought himself as unqualified. Nevertheless, upon Moses' death, Joshua was commissioned to lead the Israelites into Canaan, finally realizing God's ancient promise to give Abraham's descendants the land. So, who did the Israelites follow more willingly? If you'd asked me before I started preparing the sermon, I would have said Moses, of course. But turns out, no. In the biblical narrative, the Israelites generally followed Joshua with greater obedience and unity than they did Moses. While Moses faced constant complaining and severe rebellions like the golden calf incident, Joshua's generation displayed singular focus and compliance during the conquest of Canaan. There are several factors that I think play into this. First is, By the time Joshua led them into Canaan, the rebellious generation had died out. Moses led the wilderness generation out of Egypt. Because this group frequently doubted God and refused to enter the promised land because they were afraid of the giants there, they were condemned to wander in the desert until the entire generation perished. Joshua led their children, a hardened and unified new generation raised in the wilderness. The next is the goal was concrete and tangible under Joshua as opposed to something more ethereal under Moses. Moses led the people through the harsh, uninhabitable Sinai desert, which naturally led to anxiety and complaints. And the even though they heard about the paradise to come, what they felt was there's no water, there's no food. And at one point they said, we would rather be back in Egypt, where at least we had food and water. Have you brought us out here to die? Joshua, however, led them into the fertile, rich land of Canaan, something that they could see with their own eyes. And they knew it would improve their quality of life. And our leadership team right now, we are also in a transitional state. They're going to take a deep dive into our mission, vision, and values. These things change and refine over time, and it's a healthy thing to look at them periodically to be sure we're going in the right direction. I would not anticipate any drastic changes, really, but rather a refining and a refocusing, a clarifying. Now, y'all can help with this by communicating your thoughts to the leadership team, what's working for you, what isn't, what you value, what you question, what you love, what you don't. And of course, by praying for the leadership team and its process. They want to ensure that our mission, vision, and values are clear, clearly communicated, and something you can see, much like the Israelites under Joshua. They want to be sure that our practices illustrate our purpose. So this is something that we can learn from Moses and Joshua, rather than just say, we have a plan. We don't know what it is. But we think we want it to be clear. We want people to know. The next thing is there were differing leadership dynamics. Now, Moses was a lawgiver and a prophet, and he frequently had to act as an intermediary between a complaining public and what they perceived as a wrathful God. Moses was a setter up of systems, but Joshua was a doer. His primary role was as a military commander, whose clear directives and initial successes commanded high respect and loyalty from his followers. Now, as I said, change could be scary and disorienting, but change is healthy. Imagine the clothes that you wore when you were a toddler, right? Well, I don't think we had onesies back when most of you were there, but anyway, it's ludicrous to imagine wearing them now. Some things have to change in order to allow us to grow and achieve our potential. Our clothes are one of them. The way we do things are another. Each of our leaders at Liminal have different backgrounds, gifts, and experiences, and they've walked their own path and their own journey that has led them here. All have a piece of the answer, but none have the whole picture on their own. That makes them dependent upon one another and upon listening to God. And the bond formed by that dependence is not easily broken. So what are some qualities that are necessary and desirable for leaders to develop? What's important for your leaders to exhibit? The Bible tells us about the qualities of either Moses or Joshua that would bring them to God's, the Bible does not tell us what God saw in either Moses or Joshua that made him think they were perfect for these roles. In fact, Moses' qualifications were that he was a well-educated shepherd with a hot temper. Joshua's were that he was an able personal assistant with an ability to lead soldiers into war. But underneath, he lacked confidence and courage. In the Bible, the qualifications for a leader are a lot different than they are in our culture. They were more centered on character, spiritual devotion, and practical ability, rather than being powerful. What God is looking for is a reverent heart and obedience, integrity, trustworthy, servant's heart, and submission to God's law. God looks on the inside, on the heart. We tend to look on the outside to see who seems qualified and confident and charismatic, who has a loud voice. This is a cautionary tale for us in these times. Sometimes the loudest voice is not the one we should be listening to. Now, I want to say a few words about being qualified for a position, because first of all, none of us are. As I look through the Bible, there's something that stands out to me. God rarely picks qualified leaders. Now, that's a scary thought, but it's something we all have in common. But here's another thing. Some of us say yes to God's invitations. We follow God's leading, at least most of the time. And most of us, the best of us, keep following him even after we stray, which we do. No doubt, if you have a little voice that says, maybe I could, whatever, you have a much louder voice saying inside of you, are you insane? You have no qualifications. You have no gifting. You are inept. You are untrained. And in short, you're crazy for even considering it, and no one would want you. Anyone ever heard that voice? I have it inside me all the time. The only place I'm truly confident is sitting on the piano bench. And even there, I'm very aware that I don't read music and am basically dependent upon God to breathe music into me, because all I have in front of me is something that says G, A, C, E minor. And that's not really enough to do much. So even there, despite my almost 70 years of practicing scales and learning music, that's kind of pitiful when you think of it. But anyway, yeah, that's what I've done with my life. I've learned to play music. I've learned to play by ear. And I'm learning still that I am utterly dependent on God. Also, I'm not a naturally gifted speaker. I have no seminary training. I'm an introvert who's uncomfortable in crowds of more than 3 to 4 people. I hate being up front of people and in the spotlight. Yay. I'm a solitary writer who basically reads her writing to you. If I were being evaluated by most churches and said, hey, I'd like to deliver messages, they'd pass me by in a hot second, and they'd probably be right to do so. And yet, here I am. But there's an advantage to my lack of qualifications. I am forced into dependency on God to not only give me decent things to say to you, but to hold me up while I'm up here speaking to you. And, you know, it's no mystery why I hold on to the podium. It holds me up. I'm also becoming more and more comfortable, despite my Enneagram 5 leanings, in my INTJ Myers-Briggs, the mastermind personality, that being dependent and forced to work out of my comfort zone is a good thing. We say yes, despite our possibly better judgment, despite our fears and our trepidations, despite knowing how woefully unqualified we are, because in truth, who is qualified to lead people in terms of their faith? Nobody. But despite it all, we feel invited, interested, perhaps even called. We responded. We said yes. And those three letters have provided this church with an amazing group of folk who get together, discuss, gently wrestle, consider, pray, and come to a consensus that is more often than not unanimous, which is a miracle in a church. And that determines what we do and how we move forward. And I'm honored to have been a part of it all. That being said, there's qualifications that all of us should strive to inhabit. Those of us in leadership, those of us who are following, those of us who are unsure what part they take. And here are some of them. Humility in a servant's heart. 2 scripture verses. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value one another or value others above yourselves. And Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Scripture notes that Moses was very humble, more humble than anyone on the face of the earth. This humility allowed him to prioritize the people's needs over his own pride. A good leader recognizes that their authority comes from God and as such places needs of others before their own ambitions. Rather than seeking personal glory, they elevate those that they lead. Further, both Moses and Joshua, but especially Joshua, I think, modeled servant leadership. Neither of them lorded their power over the people, but instead used their position to support, equip, and care for their community. Can you imagine how many times Moses wanted to just say, "Stuff it, I'm going off on my own to the promised land, and y'all can just wander till your heart's content"? I mean, I would have thought of that before I hit the river. Joshua was content to serve Moses for decades as an assistant. Now, if you think of Joshua, he was not an insignificant man. I've got a picture coming up that you'll see that I just love. But anyway, you'll see. Probably nothing like what he looked like, but I like it anyway. So there. Moses and Joshua were both foundational leaders of the Israelites who shared a close mentor-mentee bond and experienced remarkably similar callings. But they were not arrogant know-it-alls. They were people of deep humility who walked humbly before God and humbly walked together. The next is integrity. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but whoever takes crooked paths will be found out. I went to Target yesterday, and I haven't been to Target in ages and ages and ages, but I went. And I went through the shopping line and I bought everything. And when I got to my car, I noticed that I had an eyebrow pencil that I hadn't paid for. It was on the bottom of the cart. I didn't see it. And I thought, I do not want to go back into Target. And then I remembered I'm preaching on integrity tomorrow. So I walked back in and I paid for it. Thank you very much. And it didn't take that much longer. And I at least was able to look at myself in the mirror. Leaders have to possess a strong moral compass. They have to be honest and above reproach. We've all heard tales of those who have not. Integrity builds trust that is necessary to guide other people and influence others. Now, I once caught one of my granddaughters in a lie, and I called her on it. And since I'm grandma, not mom, I'm not responsible for the discipline of it. So I didn't make a huge deal of it, but we did talk a bit. And I ended my lecture with, "You need to develop your moral compass." She looked at me kind of like I had two heads, and she goes, "What's that?" And I responded, "You know, it's that little thing inside you that tells you if something is right or wrong." She thought for a minute, and then she said with the most sweet sincerity, "I don't have one of those." Ah, great. What do you say after that? So we went for a walk, changed the subject, and I knew I was bested. But likely she does have one and it will grow over time, either that or we're raising a serial killer and our fingers are crossed. Fortunately, Moses and Joshua did have strong moral compasses, at least if you look at their overall trajectory. And their little voice inside of them kept calling them back to God. And it is so important in a leader. Without that, you're definitely going to head in the wrong direction because things sound awfully good sometimes. The next is wisdom. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who will give it generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. I like that, without finding fault. You ask God for wisdom, and he doesn't say, "You should know that. What kind of an idiot are you?" God doesn't say that. Rather than relying only on our own intellect or strategies, a good leader seeks divine guidance and the guidance of others to make sound decisions. If you follow the ways of Jesus, his wisdom leads to fairness, sound judgment, discernment. Leaders require practical wisdom to govern, mediate disputes, and guide the community in following God's statutes. Wisdom and discernment, at least much of the time, is gleaned from picking oneself up after failure and learning the lessons that the failure taught us. In spiritual direction, at least in the program I went through, I don't know if Still Point has this or not, probably not. They're a little more refined. We have a term called slow, silent, and stupid. And that means grow in comfort with waiting to speak. Don't rush to say something. Grow in comfort about waiting in silence. And embrace stupidity in terms of don't jump to conclusions and assume you know all the answers. I don't know that that's actually stupid. It's actually pretty wise. But there needed to be an S at the beginning of the word. So there you have it. So obedience and faithfulness. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices and as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. Leaders were held to be accountable to strictly follow God's commands. Unrepentant disobedience was often depicted as a primary cause for the downfall of leaders. And I put that in the past tense, but it certainly is true today. Remember King Saul? We talked about him last week. Obedience and faithfulness is measured, I think, not only in our successes at being obedient and faithful, but even more so what we do immediately after we fail. How quickly do we pick ourselves up and get back in the game? Which is more valuable? Think about it. Sometimes our failures can actually be blessings in disguise. Saint Ignatius would say that they are actually consolations if they turn you back to God. So don't waste time beating yourself up. Ask yourself, so what am I going to do next? Make it right. Take a step forward. The next is courage. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. You'll notice that was written to Joshua. Leading according to biblical principles often requires the courage to stand firm to the truth, even though it's unpopular and difficult. This unwavering faith is, This unwavering strength is rooted in faith rather than fear. Ironically, I don't think Moses or Joshua had much of it. I mean, if you read about them, they spend a lot of time questioning God, especially Moses, questioning themselves, both of them, and Moses flatly refused to speak without Aaron's assistance. Joshua, while he was a mighty warrior, seems to also have lacked courage because time and time again he was exhorted to be strong and to have courage. Where do we get it? By finding God to be faithful in times of trouble. Where do we get courage? Well, lots of times it comes as an afterthought. We react out of a sense of justice or morality. We find ourselves on the front line, and then we just have to do what we do. Courage isn't the absence of fear, but the choice to take action despite the fear. You build it by treating it like a muscle. You get on the front lines, you realize I'm out of my depth. I could run or I could press forward. You choose to press forward. That strengthens your muscle. Moses and Joshua teach followers the profound value of faithful service, humility, and obedience. Their relationship demonstrates that great leaders often begin as followers. And that a community thrives when individuals support their teachers while anchoring their own trust in God's promises. So what do we take from this in liminal? First, serve faithfully. Serve where you are, whether it's your job or not. Before leading, Joshua faithfully served Moses for decades as his assistant. Good followers don't strive for the top. They just serve. And they learn to delight themselves in that service in their current assignment. When you're walking along, pick up the piece of trash. If you see someone who looks sad and you're not a pastor and it's not your job, you can say, how are you doing? And stick around long enough to find out. There's a lot of things you can do, and it's all good. Wise woman once told me, be where you are. And I went home and I thought, what does that mean? Be present where you are. Keep your eyes open and see what's going around you and do what needs to be done. The next is learn from the journey. Followers share in the season of waiting and hardship. Joshua's steadfastness through the wilderness prepared him for the responsibility of crossing into the promised land. The lessons he learned, the lesson we learn on our journey, are things that God will use in us now and in the future. Nothing is wasted. It all fits together miraculously to shape us into what we are becoming. When I was 4, I started to play the piano. I was going to be a concert pianist. When I was 18, those dreams ended. And God gave me worship. Would I trade it? Uh-uh. I'd rather play for the one than for the 5,000s. It all fits together miraculously to shape us, the good, the bad, the ugly. I was mortified that I didn't know how to read music like all my cohorts. Now nobody has music for what we do. It would be absolutely useless if I had to say, do you have music? I mean, maybe James could write it out for me, I don't know. But I don't think he'd be very happy about it. James, by the way to multitask. Sorry, that was just an aside. Learn from the journey. God is not going to waste anything in your life. He will bring it back. He will use it, use the lessons from it. If nothing else, he'll use it so that you and he can laugh about it. Next is develop trust and devote yourself to God's invitations. Choose faith over fear. Oh my goodness, that sounds churchy, doesn't it? But do it. I mean, just because it's churchy doesn't make it weird. When you face the giants and the daunting prospects of new territories, God commanded Joshua to be strong and courageous. Followers learn to trust God rather than dwelling on the overwhelming size of their circumstances. Joshua saw the giants, and he thought, if God says we can take them, we can take them. Sure enough, they could. Strong followers know the outcome is not guaranteed, and in fact, it may not be what we want. But God's presence in the midst is something that we can count on. Absolutely. In the hardest times, we can take comfort from that, as Corrie ten Boom did in Ravensbrück. I don't say that right. Ravensbrück? Anyway, there, the concentration camp, where in her own despair, she learned something from her sister, who was at that moment near death in terrible circumstances. Her sister, Betsy, said, "There is no pit so deep that God's love is not deeper still." Now, those are words that you can take as truth because they are tried by fire. Trust and devotion. And it's available to us. The next is support your local leaders. I wanted to say gunfighters so bad. There is nothing like being in leadership to teach us the value of a strong support system. Aaron and Hur literally held up Moses' hands during a battle because every time his arms fell, the Israelites would begin to lose. There are those here who regularly and lovingly support our leaders in prayer by encouragement, by hugs and smiles, and you will never know how valuable that is. And we can all be that to one another. And in fact, we should. Perhaps we should try it. And like I say, so many of you do. Next is grow in humility, know when to pass the torch. Honor the legacy. Just as Moses humbled himself to prepare Joshua as his successor, Joshua demonstrated deep respect for Moses. We heard last week, David demonstrated that same deep respect for Saul, who was actually a horrible leader, but at the time he had been anointed by God and David said he would not, even though Saul had gone off the rails, would not lift his hand against God's anointed. And in fact, he was devastated when Saul was killed. Prepare to step up and know when it's time to do so. At God's command, Moses did step aside. Recognizing that no individual is indispensable. Moses didn't say, God, there is no one who can lead these people like I did. That wasn't Moses' heart. He stepped aside. Followers learn that their ultimate goal is to become empowered enough to eventually take ownership and step into new responsibilities themselves. Joshua did that. Leaders need to discern when their time for service has reached its conclusion, and followers need to discern when it's their time to step up into a more prominent role. Liminal is in a transitional stage. Not only have we moved, but the leadership team is taking this invitation to evaluate where we've been, where we are, and where we're going as a church. The leadership team is currently planning a deep dive into our mission, vision, and values. They want to evaluate what we've been doing in the past to see if it is what we should be doing in the future, or if God is calling us to new and fun things. Their part is to wrestle together, to seek input from many of you, to lay everything on the table, and to take time to discern the direction that God is taking us now, in the present. What they need from you is thoughtful input and trust. These people love Liminal and are committed to guiding it in the way it should go. They need your support. The leadership team is also bringing new, younger, fresher faces onto the team. Folks with new ideas and deep passion and similar love for Liminal. This is critical to keep Liminal alive and fresh. The newer folks will have an opportunity to work alongside some of the more seasoned leaders, and both will learn from one another in terms of how to effectively lead this lovely bunch of Liminalites. And there's room for more at the leadership table. As we've seen from Moses and Joshua, it begins with a willing and a faithful heart. And somehow, God sows into us what is necessary to do the task that he calls us to do. As we step into new and possibly challenging roles, we find out things about ourselves that we never knew were in us. There was a point in time when I was in college where I was willingly deciding to take an F in speech because I refused to speak in front of anybody. Now, I worked out a deal with my teacher that if I could do good written work, that she'd give me a C and let me go. Fortunately, I'm a good writer, so I got my C, and that was the only one I got in college, but I was happy. If you had told me then that I would be here now, I would have died, literally died laughing. I had trouble talking to one person, let alone lots. It all begins with a yes, maybe to smaller things, but perhaps to things we know will stretch us and challenge us. So if you experience that little voice in the recesses of your head that says, maybe I could, I encourage you to reach out to someone in the leadership team and explore together what that might look like, if not now, in the future. Much like a spring cleaning session, we've already begun looking at things that belong and what things can be let go. Physically, we did it by way of the move, where things that had grown dusty and shoved into corners were let go. Emotionally, by way of letting go our little black box, because it could no longer serve us. Here we have space to grow. So we come into this new space, integrating some of what we were, and being open to new things and new surroundings. And the leadership will take the same approach when it looks at what fuels Liminal, and what things are truly integral to who we are. What things may be left over from another time in another place and need to be retired to make way for the new and exciting things to come. Worship team can come back up. Transitions are never easy, but they offer invitations. to grow, to expand, to learn, to thrive, to flourish. I have no doubt that the boy Joshua, enslaved in Egypt, never contemplated that he would become the mighty warrior of Israel and eventually be the one who would lead Israel into the land promised to Abraham. Who knows what God will do with you? One of the beautiful things about Liminal is that it is not led by one person, but by a team. And the team is not a closed group, impossible to join. It is an ever-expanding entity. There is a role for everyone, room to participate in what Liminal is and what Liminal will become. John Wimber, the founder of the Vineyard, which is a part of our own history, had a saying, "Everyone gets to play." Liminal is not something to watch. It's something to participate in. And everyone, anyone, and yes, even you, can join in participating and making it, shaping it, into more than we can ever imagine. Thanks.